Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice. I hope you enjoyed the last episode in Chinese. If you didn't, or perhaps didn't understand it, you may like this next episode. Questions and answers. I'm happy to introduce Rebecca Singh back onto the episode. Ramona, Becca, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you, Mark.
I'm well as well.
All right. I know everyone is just chomping at the bit to start diving into some of these questions. And we have a lot of questions. Questions come in every day, but we've parsed just a few to cover on the show. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a step back and allow, well, you know, Becky and Mona to ask some of the questions. I've got a few here myself and I'll definitely jump in. But Rebecca, I will pass off to you and let you get started.
Great. Thank you, Mark. So my first question, as Mona knows, that we get a lot of clients who come and they want to go ahead and invest. So the big question is, when do I get my money back? How much do I get back? And who pays me back?
Good question. And I think we could have a whole episode answering that question. Very briefly, I think the question was, who pays back the EB5 investor? Is it the regional center or the project? It is always the project. The regional center is the facilitator, and it's not really the regional center at all who either really takes the money or pays the money back. The other thing is, I think that it's important for our listeners to know, your money cannot be returned under the law until your green card is permanent. So with today's dates, the fastest that could be, with today's processing times, the fastest that could be would be 3.5 to 4 years, probably not under 4 years. And yes, it's the project which pays back.
Mona, I got a follow-up question to that. So obviously they're waiting 3 or 4 years to get their money back. So during that time, their money is at risk while they have their conditional green card. Can they receive returns on that money that they have at risk, or can they not receive anything? And that money has to do its work and cumulative work while their conditional green card is in hand.
Very good question, Mark. And we do have a podcast talking about all of this area, because this is something which is coming up time and time again. And it also borders on other areas. The problem is here, yes, of course, they can get interest and they have to get interest, because when you file a petition, an investor has to file with the chance of gain as well as the chance of loss. And if you have a petition where you're getting 0% interest, USCIS will deny that because they will say there's no chance of gain. Exactly. But at the same time, if you have a project which is offering you a ridiculous amount of interest, then that's one of the red flags that often we look at to say, is this a good project? Can the project really afford to pay me this much interest and pay me my money back after a certain period of time? So I'm going to leave all of that for another day, but very quickly, you got answering your question. Yes, you have to have some interest.
So they can receive some marginal interest. Okay. Sorry, Becky, I had to jump in because I saw a question in my mind.
That's perfect.
Okay. Well, while we're asking questions, Mona, I want to ask you another question. And is, how do I decide between an EB-5 and the Diversity Visa Lottery? I want to register for the Diversity Visa Lottery, and I also want to apply for the green card through EB-5. Can I register for both of these U.S. immigration programs at the same time? Which program would I get a visa from first? And win the lottery, how much money would I lose if I canceled my EB-5 application? So it sounds like this person is investing in EB-5, but they're also going after, you know, the Diversity Visa Lottery, which I can understand. But they have a concern here that if they do both, will I risk my EB-5 money that I've invested, as well as, you know, which one would probably pan out first?
Right. Well, first of all, diversity visa lottery is what it is, a lottery. And the chances of you getting a green card on that is, I wouldn't say minimal, but it's not anything that you could really rely on. If somebody has an opportunity to file for EB-5 as well as the DV lottery, of course, the EB-5 is something you would definitely file for. Now, notwithstanding that, if some miracle happens and they do win the DV lottery, and what happens to the EB-5? Well, here it really depends on which project you've gone into and what stage you've won the DV lottery and whether or not the project has utilized your money. Technically, when you file a petition, you are signing a subscription agreement, a contract with the project and allowing them to utilize your money. And once your money has been invested into that project, then you really have to wait until the project can give you the money back. So with regards to losing money, if I canceled my EB-5 application, well, I do think there would be some money that you would lose, possibly, well, definitely legal fees and USCIS filing fees. You probably would not lose your investment and your administration fee if you told them soon enough. But again, it depends on the project.
So big picture, the diversity visa obviously is a lottery. If you go for the EB-5 program, you're going to pay your legal fees, you're going to pay your processing fees, and essentially, well, those are non-refundable because people are doing work that you asked them to do, but your investment, you could pull back.
Right. Mm-hmm. Again, it depends on the project. See, some projects keep the money in escrow for a while, and some projects are able to substitute your investment, and they'll be fine and give you the money back. But it depends on the project.
Right.
Okay, so as we know, the EB-5 petition, the investor or the main applicant can include his spouse and any children under the age of 21. However, Mona, what happens if there's a mentally challenged dependent? For instance, let's say I have a 30-year-old son with Down syndrome who's dependent on us. How can he be included in my application for EB-5?
Very interesting question. Yes. I even got a from you, Mark.
Yeah.
Okay. The big issue here is, first of all, he's over 21. He's not going to be a dependent. He will be an independent person, number one. Number two, however, notwithstanding that, somebody with Down syndrome would not be able to understand what he's signing and therefore would not legally be able to sign any documents. And if he signed the documents on his own, then that contract would be rescinded under the law and therefore really wouldn't be at risk. So a Down syndrome person could not file the contracts, but it doesn't mean to say that he could not be recipient of an EB-5 visa. In such a situation, what would happen is that the parents or the guardians would have to sign for that child. They would probably come in as a guardian ad litem, and there would be a specific clause in the PPM and in all the documents to allow them to file.
Okay.
All right. So now that's you're asking me all the questions. My turn. Here, Rebecca, I have a very interesting question here for you. We often get questions about gifts, and it's been a big deal right now as well about gifts and gifts to a U.S. business qualifying as an EB-5 investment. So here's the question. I'm a U.S. citizen, and my non-U.S. citizen friend wants to pursue an EB-5 visa by investing in my business. I'm in the process of forming that business with plans and becoming a franchisee. The franchisor is not keen on this particular way of financing our initial investment and wants the owner equity or traditional lending arrangements. My non-U.S. citizen friend would be willing to gift this money to my business. Will this type of investment be sufficient for EB-5 visa purposes? Can the investment in a U.S. business be a gift to the business?
Absolutely no. It cannot be a gift. The gift will have to be to the person who's filing the EB-5 application. So what people have to realize here is that the entity is separate from the person. So USCIS sees the business as a separate and legal entity in itself. So if you would like to gift your friend funds for EB-5 purposes, it can be done under the conditions that, one, we source his or her source of funds, and two, it will have a gift agreement to the main applicant who will receive the funds in his or her bank account And at that time, they can use the funds to invest into the EB-5 project.
Right. I think there's a little caveat to that. And I seem to recall a very sad case that came to us a few years ago, Becca. Remember, there was a lady who was fighting for custody of a child, and somehow she managed to get money gifted to her for EB-5 purposes, but it came from a corporation.
Yeah, that was really unfortunate. So in this case, she was getting her funds from her ex-husband, who had no issues at giving her the money. However, what he did is he gifted it to her from his company. And because it was in his funds, USCIS, they wouldn't see that as a legal source of funds because it's coming from the company and it wasn't money earned by the husband.
Right, because money coming from a corporation could be mixed with other monies. Mm-hmm. So it's not really a gift from a person.
Yeah, so it's considered commingling of funds because you don't know if that person legally earned the funds. It's actually the company who's making the money. And as we stated before, the company is its own legal entity. So unfortunately, in a situation like that, it would have to be sent back and redone and taken from the personal account.
Yeah, that lady lost all her money. But what happens if somebody owns the corporation 100% and it's not a sole proprietorship?
Okay, yeah. In that case, then again, it still would have to be gifted to the person in a legal manner and taken from the personal account rather than the corporate account.
Yeah, because a corporation is still considered an entity.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
Okay, well, thank you for that, Mona and Rebecca. So what I'm hearing on my end is that a gift can be accepted, but it cannot be gifted directly into the business on behalf of the EB-5 investor or EB-5 petitioner. It actually has to be gifted to that foreign national, and then they take that money, that gift, and then invest it into the business. And obviously, this gets very complicated when you look one level, two levels, 10 levels down as far as, was it a person to person or business to person or business to business, whatever. But it sounds like the simplest form of this is person to person would be allowed. Am I correct in understanding that?
Yes.
Okay. We'll stop with that. Yes. Okay. I love the concise answer. Yes. It makes it simple.
You summed it up so well.
Exactly. Why confuse it anymore? Because it does get more confusing when you go more levels down.
Yeah.
So that having been said, I know we have another question here. So Mona, would you like to ask this question?
Right. Here, Becca, this is another question for you. I recently got my EB-5 green card, but I'm not entirely prepared to live in the United States. Do I have a time limit to enter the U.S.? And if I wait for a while, will this affect my chances of getting U.S. citizenship later?
Okay, so we do get this question a lot from a lot of our clients who are doing consular processing because they're excited to get the green card, and then they get the green card or they're ready to go to their interview, and then they're said, oops, I'm not ready to move on, just because they haven't sold their property as yet or they haven't finished up any business or school. So when you get your interview, at the time you get your visa to enter the U.S., you do have 6 months. That gives you some time. You don't have to enter right away. If not, if you're still not ready within 6 months of entering the U.S., what we could do is you can also apply for a reentry permit. So you could file for your reentry permit if you're going to be outside of the U.S. for a year or longer, and then you would get it for 2 years.
And I believe you can only reapply for a multi-entry once more. So you can be out for a maximum of 4 years before you actually have to make an entry.
Yes. And then even after getting your green card, you can travel in and out of the United States. But we do advise that if you are out longer than 6 months, then there's a case that USCIS may say that you're abandoning your green card.
Right. And when you actually do apply for your reentry permit, Rebecca, do you have to be in the U.S. or can you do it from overseas?
You will have to be in the U.S. before applying for that. So you will have to be here, apply for your reentry permit. Once you get that, then you can leave. And you'll have 2 years outside of the U.S. without abandoning your green card.
But it does cut your time for citizenship.
It sure does.
So if you do take a reentry permit and you want to start qualifying all the time that you've been in the United States for citizenship purposes, then the clock starts all over again.
Okay. I really want to take this next question because it's one I've heard myself before. And when I saw it submitted, I'm like, oh, I would definitely want to field this question to both Rebecca and Mona. So feel free to jump in and combine answer this question. So here it is. I have a friend in New York who claims that he will be getting a green card within 2 years because he purchased a house for around $500,000. I did some research and found that I can apply for an EB-5 while on H-1B and get a green card if I invest around $500,000 and create 10 full-time jobs. But what I found online seems to contradict what my friend has told me, hence the reason for this podcast, but that's my own interjection here. So the question is there any scenario where I could be eligible for EB-5 if I purchase a house?
Quick answer to that is no.
That's the quick answer is no. For most cases, especially this case, they bought a house for $500,000. But he does understand, he or she does understand that they need to create 10 full-time jobs.
Right.
And what does that mean? So
well,
now,
there's a confusion here because the European programs don't have this job creation requirement. And you can qualify for investment by just purchasing a house. And it's not just Europe. It's also in places like the UAE. So there are many countries where you can do that. And to give the person some credit, there was legislation introduced by Senator Chuck Schumer back a few years ago called EB-6, which was relating to a visa if you had purchased real estate. But that didn't get through.
Exactly. So we're not focusing on the EB-6, nor are we focusing on the UK. Exactly. Yeah. So it's 1 through 5. And obviously, this whole show is about the EB-5. But I love the way this person phrased this question because it reminds me of my show Mythbusters, when they bust a myth and they say, all right, how far can we take this extreme? And this person worded this just exactly so, and is there any scenario where I could be eligible for the EB-5 if I purchase a house? And for me, I'm here in Atlanta, Georgia. The Biltmore State is in North Carolina. It's the largest private estate, bigger than the White House. It's a huge, obviously more than $500,000. So I think what their question is, I think they understand that they can't purchase a home for $500,000, but they're specifically asking what scenario, and I understand this could be an extreme scenario, but what scenario of purchasing home would make it eligible for EB-5. So Mona, Rebecca, I ask this of both of you. What's the extreme scenario of which you could think, yeah, I would feel comfortable in putting this in an EB-5 case on the purchase of a private home?
Well, only if your house was huge and you are having a whole army of full-time employees, such as a full-time gardener, full-time cook, a full-time butler.
Maid, yes.
And perhaps, you know, you have your construction workers took 2 years because you have this extremely Versailles type garden.
That's what I was thinking. I was thinking if you can get 2 years to build your house, I can count the construction workers maybe right. Then.
So obviously we're not talking about a $500,000 home, but like a multi-million dollar estate where you also have support staff. But let me ask you this. It really isn't asking this question, but what about the return on investment? Is there any way that you would need to, and again, I'm taking extreme case and even stretching it even further, how would you in the petition state that this was an investment?
Oh, so it's a chance of gain or a chance of loss.
Yeah, which is what you need for an EB-5, right?
Exactly.
Well, technically, you could have a project. I mean, we joke here, but say it was a project that, and you are building this large place, this house, and you are intending to employ real employees. Yes, you could have an entire project set up.
Yes, and the jobs could be created for more than 2 years. But as far as a chance for gain and chance for loss, I guess your chance of gain will be the property value.
Right.
You know, how much would your property or what you've built on the property would cost in the next 5-10 years.
But I'm sure USCIS would look at the viability also of it all. So.
Right. So the short answer for this is the person that submitted this question is you are right. You know, when your friend told you that they can purchase a house for $500,000 and that's EB-5, you were thinking about creating full-time jobs. You were absolutely right. That scenario that your friend outlined to you would not qualify, but hopefully in jest, we've kind of painted an extreme scenario of what type of home would qualify for an EB-5. And certainly it's much more than $500,000 when you start talking about creating not just the temporary construction workers, but like the full-time jobs. So, okay, well, let's move on to the next question. Rebecca, I want to ask this of you, and that is, I am a 65-year-old retired doctor from the United Kingdom. Now, Mona, I realize you're originally from the United Kingdom, so I'm going to ask Rebecca this. My wife and I are considering obtaining U.S. permanent residency with the goal of eventually getting our citizenship. and we have heard of the EB-5 program as a possible option. We are wondering if there is an age limit for the EB-5 eligibility. Keep in mind, this person's 65-year-old retired doctor. And if my retirement would disqualify me from applying, who is allowed to apply for the EB-5 program? So I think it sounds like they have some retirement income. Mm-hmm. I assume this person definitely has a ton of accumulated assets, but they're 65 years old. Does age limit play into the EB-5 program?
Not at all. So a 65-year-old, you can be 100 years old and you can apply for the EB-5 program. So there's no age limit as far as where it concerns, you know, if they're retired, as long as they can show the source of their funds. Now, the issue comes into play, though, is if we've had clients ask us if their child is under 18.
Right. This is a big deal going on right now, Mark. That's very, it's very true that older, yeah, it's fine. As long as you're able to sign a document. But what about under that? Because visa retrogression right now means that in China, children, visa retrogression for mainland China people, Chinese people that is, children at the age of 15 and 16 are considering applying for EB-5. And for this, we would say no. Unfortunately, they would not be able to. It would be the same scenario, actually, as the child with the Down syndrome, because the contract would be able to be rescinded as soon as the child was 21, and therefore would not be a valid contract. So the only way around this is, again, a guardian ad litem.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Okay, so one of the other questions that we have, one of our investors asked that they saw that the legislation might get passed in September to make the EB-5 program safer for investors, but the minimum investment amount is probably going to go up at the same time. I want to make the lower investment, but I am wondering if it is better to instead wait until the program is made safer. How safe is the EB-5 program right now without the changes? How can I safely choose an EB-5 project before the program changes are made in September?
Well, that's a very deep question. It's, again, going to take a whole podcast to answer all of these things.
It sounds like there's really two parts. Should I do it now or should I wait? Mm-hmm. And if I do now, how can I safely choose an EB-5 project?
Yeah. Well, the first part of the question is don't wait if you want to pay the lower amount. Do it now because waiting is not going to keep that lower amount from going up. With regards to making the program safer, well, I can tell you that everybody, all the government services, SEC, USCIS, they're all working on trying to make this program as safe as possible. And it's not something that is going to happen just in September. It's happening every day. USCIS have announced that they are going to do random site visits on projects. They're looking at projects very carefully. Whichever time we see a project which seems to take a longer period of time to adjudicate, often we wonder if USCIS has found a problem with that. And that often USCIS will look and they'll say, look, we're not very happy with this business plan. We're not very happy with the way you're showing the funding in this business plan or where the funding is coming from or what your contingencies are. So they are really thinking about the project as we file. So I wouldn't say that you want to wait because I feel as though USCIS are doing it today. But of course, with integrity measures coming in, some things are going to be mandatory later. So it would obviously make the program stronger at a later stage also.
So it sounds like the recommendation is if you want to get the lower amount, now's the time to do it, because whatever happens in September, they're certainly not going to lower the amount. In fact, they may even raise it. But the second part of this question that Becky was asking is how can this investor safely choose an EB-5 project before the program changes are made in September? So are there any funds or perhaps are there any attorneys that are making, you know, above and beyond, you know, the letter of the law measures or due diligence and really look, taking this with scrutiny. So how can this person make the safest possible investment now at the lowest possible amount?
Well, I have a problem with this here, Mark.
Let's
actually
hear it.
I due diligence, with all due respect to all the people who do due diligence out there, a lot of things are industry related, and I find that sometimes due diligence people don't look at some of the industry related issues. For real estate, yes, definitely a lot of things you can see your yourself. You, when you go and visit the project and you look at all the documents and you have some due diligence company come in and have a look at what the documents state and where the financing, etc. is coming from. But for non-real estate projects, there's a different expertise really involved. And I feel like the investor themselves is the best judge often to go and look at the project and get a feel and use their own logic, as well as perhaps using a company which does some due diligence.
Okay.
These due diligence companies, though, do charge quite a lot of money, Mark. I know we've had people on the show and we will be having people on the show. But for an investor who really wants to utilize them, then they really have to think about spending a considerable more money out of pocket.
Well, it doesn't seem like the concerns of the question that Rebecca read is really, you know, how do I get the cheapest EB-5 possible? But it sounds like their concern is, well, they want to make the lowest investment amount possible, but they also want it to be the safest amount. And due diligence sounds like it's a route that they could go. But Mona, as you correctly identified, most EB-5 programs are real estate programs. So most EB-5 due diligence people are keenly aware of risk related to real estate. But some of these other programs that are popping up, whether they are not real estate, maybe it's a brewery or transportation project, that particular due diligence person may not understand the industry. As you pointed out, they're not looking so much at what the risk of the industry is. So then maybe they look at, you know, the principles involved in the project. So,
right. And then there are times, sorry, Mark, there are times that if, for example, there's a project which is related to revenue, such as an amusement park, then it's if all the things are there, it's chance as to whether or not that amusement park takes off, really.
Right. So I'm obviously not advocating for any one particular fund, and I want to state that up front because it sounds like my next statement may indicate that some funds are safer than others. But it sounds like what I'm hearing is make the investment now. Don't wait until September. But your safest bet is probably real estate, which most people understand. And other industries, they may not really understand the risk.
No, we would argue you down on this, Mark. I would not.
Oh, okay.
I would
well, not great. I'm going to hear this argument. Yeah, go for it. No. Because that's the conception I had in my mind based off what was stating. So jump in.
I am certainly not knocking real estate because, first of all, 90% of most mm-hmm. EB-5 projects are real estate based, but not all real estate is safe real estate. In fact, just today, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about the luxury condo boom ending in Manhattan. And that's a big shock. Real estate has its own set of issues. There are several problems that can happen with real estate. In construction, for example, there are many issues which could happen, which could slow construction down. There could be, real estate could be over-leveraged. And yes, okay, there is land and there are bricks and mortar, but when that's been so over-leveraged and the repayment is through refinance, then an investor may not necessarily get his money back. Refinancing right now is at 30% of the value mm-hmm. of the property. And if the value of the property is going down, 30% may not be enough, especially if there are other people before you. So there are lots of problems which have come up in our experience over a period of time related to real estate. Again, I'm not knocking all real estate. There are some fantastic real estate projects, but not all. You should never have a blanket statement which says all real estate is good, because that's not necessarily true. And in our experience, it hasn't been. We've found great projects in other industries.
So really the gist here is they're asking, when should I do it? And it sounds like the if you want to get that lower investment, the time is now. But really, I interjected real estate because of the unknowns with other industries, as you point out before. But really their question is, how can I safely choose an EB-5 project? So instead of industries, would you point to teams or experienced people such as Mona Shaw and Associates? Of course, I could say that since I'm a podcaster over here. But yeah, how can they safely choose?
Yes. I mean, a good experienced attorney does make a difference. And remember, though, an attorney isn't allowed to give financial advice. But we are allowed to give advice through the course of our business. So through the course of our business, if we find a project that we think is very safe or our team, we certainly can comment on it. And we do. We often say, look, we deal with this particular regional center group all the time, and we think they're wonderful people. We know how careful they are with their documents and how careful mm-hmm. they are with their projects. So we do these type of recommendations, but we have to be careful ourselves, Mark.
All right. So it sounds like the time is now, and the best way to safely choose an EB5 project is to have a good team. So I want to jump in with this next question. Maybe it's out of order here, but I think it's a great follow-up question. And that is, how will my EB5 case be affected if my attorney is disbarred? So here's the background on this question. My attorney submitted my I-526 petition. That's the initial EB5 petition. It's September 2014. I'm trying not to laugh. This is a very serious issue. My EB5 case is to join and personally manage a franchise restaurant. At the time, my attorney had legal practice status. Just now, I found out that he is no longer eligible to practice law. How will my EB5 case be affected? When will USCIS open my case? It's still in receive status. Read that my lawyer has been disbarred and then deny my case automatically. Again, I'm reading this verbatim, but it sounds like the gist is their initial EB5 petition is pending. Their attorney was disbarred, which again goes to have a good, established, credible team. But this person is obviously kind of past that point. You know, what's going to happen to their EB5 case?
Well, it sounds incredible when you say it that way, Mark, and we do laugh, but immigration attorneys are known to do some shady things, just like any other attorney, and disbarment does happen, mm-hmm. unfortunately. And it sounds like here, as there's been a considerable amount of time which has passed since the case was submitted, that there is something wrong with the petition, and perhaps USCIS is sitting on it, or perhaps something did come out and the attorney didn't even bother to say or tell the investor. If your attorney is disbarred, it should not make a difference on your EB5 petition per se, and you can transfer your case at any time from one attorney to another mm-hmm. attorney. The investor really cannot really rely on the fact that, oh, it wasn't really my fault because the attorney did it wrong. I think the issue here would be that he would just have to refile his petition.
So it sounds like it wouldn't automatically be tossed out just because, well, their attorney was tossed out. But
no.
If there
no.
is an issue, so that's laid to rest. So like just because your attorney was disbarred, your case is not tossed out. But the other one is, well, what's happening with my case? What would you recommend for this person whose attorney can no longer practice law, but their case is still pending? Is there a way to transition the case, or how can they actively manage, well, their own immigration petition
right.
and work with another attorney?
Right. But I also think that the person is perhaps getting a little confused with the fact that if a regional center goes down, do you lose your ability to continue, and that probably they're putting their attorney in the same category. But at this point, what this person needs to do is go to another attorney as mm-hmm. soon as possible and try and have the new attorney look at the documents, contact USCIS, find out what's going on, where the petition is, and see if something can be salvaged.
So it sounds like, just to paraphrase, your case isn't scrapped, but you should, since this attorney is, and I'm reading verbatim here, no longer eligible to practice law, you should seek a knowledgeable EB5 attorney that is eligible to practice law and basically transition the case to them.
Right.
Yes.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Or call the office at 212-233-7473. Don't worry about trying to write all this down, as it's already embedded in your podcast player of choice. The contact information and other valuable resources can be found there. I hope you enjoyed today's question and answer episode. I've got a feeling with all the questions coming in, we'll probably do it again soon. Next week, we're going to be talking about EB5 direct pooled investments, but from a developer's perspective. Make sure you don't miss it by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.